I'm going to attempt not to break into a scholarly role today. We're continuing on with our last week of Jesus' life. If you remember, we started last week in our series of Lent, and we're walking through each day as Jesus lived them, all the way up to his last day. And today I find it to be a little bit of a struggle. Because Mark, we're using Mark's text, and Mark does something extremely fun throughout his entire gospel, and they're called Markan sandwiches. And basically what this is you have a text interspersed with a story with the finishing conclusion of that text. And so, if I was planning this out and I wasn't planning on each specific day, I would actually start with the fig tree, which is where we're starting, the fig tree and Jesus' curse, and then you have the trouble in the temple where Jesus goes in the temple, and then I would conclude it with the wrap-up story of the fig tree, which is what Mark does. Mark has the fig tree, he has the temple, and he has the conclusion of the story. And the reason why Mark does this is because he is telling the story through a broader narrative. And so he places the temple in the middle of these two sandwich stories so that people can get an inference, so they can get an understanding of the text. Now again, I'm going to attempt not to do that today. As best I can, because we have a different purpose through this Lenten season, and that is to relive the days of the last few days of Jesus' life. And so last week we talked about the triumphal entry, we talked about the disciples coming in and getting the donkey and bringing it out and them riding it in and being hailed as king, and we went to the Old Testament and we talked about what people thought of and wanted to communicate in the idea of the Messiah and how Jesus begins to flip everything upside down and that Jesus was really a king that no one wanted. And yet no one understood they didn't want him yet because he was so anti what they wanted. And so as they're coming in, they're taking their cloaks off just like they did for King Jehu. And they're laying them at the feet of Jesus so that Jesus walks in, Jesus rides in on cloaks and palm branches to signify that he's the king. And yet the religious leaders are thinking, this guy is just trouble. Today we're continuing on in that story. Jesus, the very first thing he does when he rides in is he goes to the temple, but it's late and things are happening. So he leaves the town and we pick up the story today. Mark 11, starting in verse 12, and we're going to read 12 to 19. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard it. And they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple, and he began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he was teaching them and saying to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations?' But you have made it a den of robbers." And the chief priests and the scribes heard it and were seeking a way to destroy him. For they feared him, because all the crowd was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, he went out of the city. Second day. It's going to be a really puzzling story. It doesn't always make the sense that we want it to make. Jesus enters the city, he goes in and he sees everything that's happening in the temple. And he's not happy with what's going on in the temple, but it's so late in the day that he leaves the city and he goes out. And the next morning he wakes up and he's going back to the city and he's hungry. And he sees a tree off in the distance. And so he goes over to that fig tree and he looks for food. Now, I want to put this in perspective. A lot of us have been to Julian. We've been apple picking in the fall, and fall is a great time to go apple picking. Even in our backyard, we've got this tree that has hundreds and hundreds of apples on it during apple season. And they're starting to get some leaves. Our trees are very confused in our backyard right now. It was nice and it was warm. It was sunny. We had some warm rains. Everything is in bloom in my backyard. And there's leaves everywhere. And so you can go out and you can see the tree and there's leaves everywhere. But you know, it's winter. And if I go up to that tree and I look for an apple, I know there's not going to be any apples on there. And if there is an apple, it's from last season, it's not one I want to eat right now. Here, Jesus walks up to this tree. And I wonder what his disciples are thinking, because they see Jesus walk up to this tree. They know it's not fig season. It would be weird to try to harvest a fig in this time period. And Jesus goes up. And he curses it. And I wonder what you would think if we were walking through Julian right now and I walked up to a tree and looked up, saw no apples, and I cursed the tree and said, "Tree, no one will ever eat from you again." I think you would all think, I think the stress of being a pastor has finally gotten to him. He has gone crazy. Here's Jesus in full view of his disciples cursing a tree. Maybe Jesus was just hungry. Right? The text says he was hungry. And we do some very strange things when we're hungry, right? Anyone ever seen those Snickers commercials? You know? They're completely different people until they take a bite of a Snickers. My wife calls it being hangry. I'm hangry. And I don't know about you, we carry food everywhere we go. I brought a lunch pail of snacks yesterday to Fresh Start, not because my kids were going to need it. It was packed in my kids' lunch pail, but because I knew my wife was going to need it. She would need the banana and the tangerine and the nuts that were inside of it. Maybe Jesus was just hungry. Or maybe something more profound is going on here. And I think the only way to really see this puzzle is to look at the context of the story that's around it. So let's look at the symbolism. Jesus goes to this fig tree, and it looks like a healthy, pretty robust tree. It's got leaves, it's green, it's vibrant. It looks like there's a lot of stuff going on, and yet it's bearing no fruit. Then Jesus goes to the temple, and what does he find? All kinds of activity. The temple is robust. There's a lot of life. It looks healthy. People are coming and going and buying and selling, and all of these things are happening. There's a ton of trade going on. Let me explain something about the temple. Has it been a while since we went through Ezekiel? Maybe you guys have forgotten about the pictures that we've thrown up on the screen up there. But when you talk about the temple was a building in the very middle, and around the temple was the courtyard. And it was the Gentiles' courtyard. It was the one area the Gentiles could actually enter into. And everyone who came to Jerusalem was supposed to bring a tax. It was called the temple tax. And you would bring that money to the temple. It was a way that you could bring in income for the town. You could bring in income for the Jewish faith. There was all kinds of different things that could go on. But around this temple, where everyone could go, people had set up shop and were selling and buying things. And Jesus does something that no one else was doing. He stops it all. In the midst of all that is going on, Jesus stops it. In fact, not only does he stop it, but in certain other gospels, we see he actually builds a whip. Jesus gets a little violent here. Mark has him flipping over tables, running animals. Picture this. They're in a big city. Picture animals running down the middle of the street because Jesus just freed them from their captives. Think of the commotion. Think of the fight. Think of the frustration of all the people who were trading and lending and buying and selling. Let's break down this text just a little bit. There are a few ways that scholars look at it, and I'll give you all the ways, and then I'll tell you what I think about it, and you can agree with me or not. But there's this temple tax, right? And everyone had to bring this temple tax to the temple. But the temple only accepted a certain currency. And so some scholars say that there was this convenience that was set up to be in the middle of this courtyard so that people could come and they'd come from all over the Roman world and they'd bring their money and their money was in this currency and they needed this currency. So there was this little exchange. And some scholars say, you know, this exchange had gotten out of hand. It was instituted for convenience, but really what it started doing was people were taking advantage of other people who were coming. So you would come and you needed $3 or $5 or whatever to pay the temple tax, and you would give them a 10 and they would give you 5 back. They would keep 50% or 30%, or they were gouging the people who were coming. Anyone ever go to a different country? And in the middle of the airport, there's always those currency exchange places. Don't ever get currency there. They're not the actual exchange rates. They take fairly hefty prices out of those currency exchange rates. And that's what some scholars say could be happening here. Some argue that what Jesus was doing was he was stopping a corrupt practice. Now, others say it's not so much the practice, but the matter that commerce is happening in the temple. That this convenience was set up and people stopped sacrificing. It's no longer hard. So the rich people would come and they'd come into the town and instead of bringing their sacrifice from where they lived, which was what they were supposed to do, they were like, oh, it's just easier. I'm just going to buy my sacrifice at the temple. Why should I go through the hard work of prepping the animal, keeping the animal safe and moving the animal and getting the animal into... Why should I go through all that sacrifice? I've got the money. I can just show up. I can pay a little bit extra. It's no big deal. Right? Why do I need to work hard to serve when I can just pay a little extra and I'll get it the same way? That the commerce was really what began to upset Jesus. The business. And you can see, Jesus doesn't just frustrate those who are buying, but he drives those who are buying and selling. Both people are being driven out of the area. So he's not just mad at those who were exchanging money and getting rich on it. He's not just mad at those who are selling the animals and getting rich on it. He's mad at those who are buying as well. He drives both out of the temple. Maybe we can learn a little bit from Jeremiah. The text that Jesus quotes is found in Jeremiah. It's a reference from Jeremiah. And Jeremiah is talking to the people about the temple. And the whole reason he writes this is the people had used the temple as a way to feel God's security. And so they were living their life however they wanted, but they were thinking, as long as I can make it to the temple, as long as I make it to the temple on Sabbath, God will protect my life. So it doesn't matter what I do over here. As long as I go to church, I'm okay. As long as I enter the doors, as long as I'm okay here, God will take care of me there and I can do whatever I want. And Jeremiah says, no, you're polluting the temple. You're polluting the church. In fact, when the people of God try to exploit God, God didn't stand for it. And God took the temple away. Remember that whole year we spent in Ezekiel? The brutal, brutal year we spent in Ezekiel? We're halfway through. God says, okay, I'm leaving. Here I am. I'm now at the door of the temple. Is anyone even watching? Does anyone even care? I'm leaving. And then God moves out to the gates. He says, I'm leaving the city. And bad things are going to come. But I cannot be a part of the sin and brokenness. And God moves out of the city and we see the destruction and the pain that comes from it. Jeremiah says, you're trusting that God is going to take care of you just because you're coming to the temple, but you're not bearing any fruit. You're not living the right way. Jesus comes into the temple and he sees a bunch of people coming and going. It's alive with business and activity, and yet Jesus is saying, there's no fruit here. This is supposed to be a house of prayer. So Jesus clears the place out so there can be space for what is supposed to happen in the temple. There can be space for prayer. The point is that the temple looked alive, but they weren't doing the right thing. They weren't bearing fruit. They just looked green. And that's a condemnation on the temple. Jesus curses the fig tree. And I always find this strange. Here's this tree, and its curses, no one will ever eat from you again. That is a major, major curse. And we're supposed to hold that in tension with what Jesus then does in the temple. So what does this mean for the church today? That's the historical context. That's the text in a glimpse of the days of Jesus. That's kind of what's going on here. That's what Mark is doing with the gospel. But what does that mean for the church today? I think that the church has to be very careful with how it acts in the world. And I think that Christians need to be very careful and need to make sure the reason why we come and the reason why we live the Christian life. Because the Christian life, we should not live the Christian life for our own sake. Christianity is not for me. But we live our lives, we live sold out for God for the sake of the gospel. I mean, that's the terminology that we see in Scripture. So the sake of the gospel may be preached. Our world has a problem. A problem our world has is we like to consume things. There's a guy named Paul Anka, I think I pronounced his last name right, who penned a song in 1968. And that song was made famous by one of the greatest singers, I would say, whoever were. Anyone know what song he wrote? You'll know after I say the artist. Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra sang this song, I'll Do It My Way. And it became his signature song. It rose to the height of the 27th best songs of history. It was the 27th All-Star chart. Oddly, it also became the most popular song used in British funerals. I want it my way. I'll do it my way. The last part of the song says this, for what is man? What has he got? If not himself, then he has not. I say the things that he truly feels, and not the words of the one who kneels. The record shows I took the blows and did it my way. 1968. This is consumerism. I did it my way. I want it my way. Anyone remember the Whopper jingle? Now, what's the Whopper jingle? Have it your way. Hold the pickles, hold the lettuce. Special orders, don't upset us. All we ask is that you let us make it your way. Right? I mean, these are commercials we grow up with. This is what we want you to do. Have it whatever you want. I mean, Starbucks, I was looking on their website. 87,000 different combinations you can make between sizes, between shots of cappuccino, between strength of coffee, strength of water, between whipped cream, no whipped cream, between cream, sugar, honey, caramel, all the different 87,000 combinations. I don't drink coffee, so it doesn't help me at all. But it's all so you can have it your way. Now, some people don't even like Starbucks. So we're going to go to the coffee shop right across the street, which probably serves the same coffee, just a little bit different. Or we're so sure we make it much better in our own home, so we're going to roast our own coffee beans. We're going to grind them in our house. We're going to take time. We're going to hand grind each every bean. We're going to put it. How much different does that make our coffee? We want it our way. PBS did a special in 2003, which is a little bit of time ago, but it's called The Merchants of Cool. If you have a chance, it's a fun watch. And one of the things that it has in there is it has a 13-year-old, and this is what the 13-year-old says. I have to look good every day. I don't dare go to my friend's house if I don't look good. It would ruin my day if I didn't look good. And yet, you know, what is this idea of good? We're all shaped by something. My wife thinks I look good in Argyle sweaters, and I'm just not sure about that. Right? She wants me in khaki slacks with an Argyle preppy sweater with something white tied around. She likes the preppy look. Somehow she married me. I don't know how it happened. In fact, we've got pictures of us standing next to each other with my long hair from college. And you know, that was one of the very first things that happened, was my hair went from here to here. Right? Shorter hair, you trying to impress. What someone defines what cool is. Someone says, this is what cool is. And so we sign up for it. Maybe it's holes in the jeans. Maybe it's a certain jacket. Maybe it's a certain brand. Maybe it's the glasses we wear, or it's the way we hold our hair, or whatever it is. We buy into something. Maybe it's the motorcycle we drive, or the car we use, or maybe we get our sense of self-worth and our sense of cool by not being what everyone else thinks is cool. But then that is still defined by what everyone else thinks. Because they think something's cool, and we're like, no, we're going to be a rebel, so this is what I think is going to be cool. We're still defined by something. Time magazine, in an article recently, wrote this: cool may be our country's most precious natural resource, an invisible, impalpable substance that can make a particular brand of an otherwise interchangeable product, a sneaker, a pair of jeans, an action movie, fantastically valuable. Now, I want to say this is not an anti-marketing sermon. But this is a sermon to say we need to think about what we're doing. In an article for Baylor University Center of Ethics, Professor Mark Medley says, consumerism is a character-cultivating way of life. Consumerism as a character-cultivating way of life encourages the least attractive human trait. Avarice, which is another word for greed, aggression, and self-centeredness. As consumerism, especially at the century's end, becomes an increasingly intrinsic and individualistic and private affair, we risk losing key virtues that stabilize and promote social life. Things like care for others, compromise, friendship, responsibility to the past, and felt obligations for the future. We live in a consumer culture. We live in a hoarder, buyer, user culture. And so one of the things that we need to do is, what is consuming, or what are we consuming? How are we using it? And what's it caused by? And so there's just a few things that it's caused by. We'll go through these very quick. Consumerism is caused by ease and laziness, selfishness and ignorance. All of these things occur in our story today. The temple, there is this ease of use. It's easier to get my money changed at the temple. I don't have to worry about bringing proper currency. It's easier just to buy my animal there, because if I bring my animal, I actually have to take care of my animal. I have to make sure it doesn't get hurt, there's no blemishes. So it gets to the temple, and it looks good, and it looks well, and everything is good. That's a risk that I have to sacrifice, because I have to spend more time taking care. I can't just go quickly. There's an ease. There's a laziness here. There's a selfishness that we see on the opposite side. Hey, you know, they want to be lazy? I'll just charge them extra for it. You know, you don't want to get the proper currency to give the temple tax? Okay, that's fine. You need 3? Give me 5. I'll give you back 3 of the proper currency. I'll make a little bit of money. You'll make a little bit of money by having the proper currency. Selfishness. And maybe even ignorance all around. Right? This is just the way things are. This is how life is. This is, I don't know anything else. I don't know any other way. This is just how things go. So to kind of get around this, I want to talk about a few things. The first thing I want to talk about is ways to move from an ease, a laziness, selfishness, and ignorance is reflection. Taking the time to be a reflective person. Pondering things, slowing down. That's an extremely important one. Maybe it's just my generation, but we can find more things than we can do in a day to try to stick in our day. Between work, between family, between kids, between fun, between, you know, outings, between shopping, between all the different things that we need to do. Our day's gone. And we've never slowed down. We've never taken time to breathe, to pray, to examine, to think, to ask questions. We need to ask questions such as, what is God calling me to do? Not what do I want to do, but what is God calling me to do? Where is God leading me? Now, if you get nothing else out of today, listen to the next 5 minutes. This is extremely important. Our job as Christians, our job is not to come to church. It is to be the church. Okay, hear this. Our job is not to come to church, but it is to be the church. We as Christians are not supposed to simply attend service every week. We are good with God because we attend. That's not the way the Christian walk is supposed to be. That's not what Christianity is about. Our job is to be the church. To live out the call that God places on our lives. To even try to figure out what that call is. God, what are you calling me to? To share the gospel with those who are around us. We are shepherds. The pastor is the main shepherd. I am supposed to take care of you. I'm supposed to really lead you in the way that we're supposed to be walking and help you in your discovery of your call. But it's your call. I can't tell you what you're called to. It's your call. It's the call that God has placed on your life. And every time we see it in Scripture, we see God dictating that call to people who sometimes are not happy with the call. Right? Moses at the burning bush, go free my people. God, you know, I think you have the wrong person. Right? I stutter. God, I think you're calling the wrong person. I think you're really calling this person over here. That's no, it's you. Trust me. I know you. I created you. You're good. Go. Our job is not to come to church, but to be the church. So reflection. Learning how to take instruction. listening to those who have been before and to those who are coming after, listening to what God is saying in our lives, taking instruction from the Bible. These are things that are extremely important that will help us not just to come to church, but to be the church. Now, there is a way out of this consumeristic lifestyle, and it all has to do with our focus. Because consumerism deals with me. It's things that I take in. It's things that I buy. It's things that I do. A lot of times that's what we see in church too. I'm going to do this, you know, follow me. I'm going to do X, Y, Z. No, it's God working through us. So the things that we need to do is change our focus from me to God. This seems like a very easy, simple task. But so many things can get in the way of our view of God. In fact, anything can. Our pride, our desire, our time, our pleasures, our lives, our job, our family, our fill in the blank. All those things are good things, but all those things can come between us and God. It's about focusing on God. In the text, the temple and all that is going on around, making sure we have the right sacrifices, making sure we're doing the right things, all of that got in the way of God. They were so focused on what they were supposed to do, the acts of worship, that they forgot to worship. We can focus on the things we're supposed to do and miss the very thing we are called to do. So let me say this. Worship is not about how you feel. It's not about how God raises goosebumps. Let me give you the actual definition of worship. Worship is the feeling or expression of reverence and adoration for a deity. That is the definition of worship. Worship is the feeling or expression of reverence and adoration for a deity. It has nothing to do with what's happening for me. It's not about the songs that we sing or the activities that we do, but it's who we're doing them for. It's not about the way things make me feel. It's not about the lighting or the mood or the life or the songs in the background. That's not what worship is. It's not about that starry-eyed feeling or do I love this song? Is the scripture right? Is the song in the right key for me to sing? None of that matters. We do not worship for me. Sometimes we think, you know, we have the worship team up here and the people down there are the audience. There is no audience in this room. There is no audience in this room. There is not people up here playing for the people down there. The audience for all of our worship is God. So we play for one audience, God. So it doesn't matter what we do, how we raise our hands, how we clap. Sometimes maybe we need to be uncomfortable and clap. Because it's not about how we're feeling. It's about giving our bodies to God. It's not about what we're getting, it's about what we're doing and why we're doing it. God becomes the audience. We are the performers. We're putting on a worship service, not for us, but for God. So we focus on God. We focus on our call, what God is calling us to do. I can tell you right now, it is not only to come to church on Sunday. Your call is not just to fill a seat. That is not your call. Your call is greater than that. Your call is an adventure. Your call is something amazing that God has chosen and specifically gifted you for. It's an adventure that you will be on for the rest of your life. God is moving you in a direction that He just wants you. So we focus on God, we focus on our call, and we focus on others. There's something in us that we like doing things our own way. Ellie can put her seatbelt on, and now she's very frustrated if anyone else wants to help. I can do it my own self, Dad. Pushing the hands away. Dad, don't do that. You can help me unbuckle because I don't have the strength in my thumbs yet, but do not buckle me. Dad, do not open that door. I've got it. They will fight tooth and nail to get out of that car, to get in and open the front door and close the garage. They are going to fight over and over for it. Because they can do it. I can do it myself. They've got this little Hot Wheel car that they like to drive around, and Ellie got stuck on the gate. Caleb's at school. Ellie's going in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. And it took her probably 10 minutes, but she would not let me go out and just pick the car up and set it on a straight path. It took her probably 10 minutes just doing this, just a little bit of a turn every single time until she could actually get through the gate. It was painful to watch. We still have that I can do it myself mentality. We're just better at hiding it or convincing others that what we're really doing is for them, when it's actually for us. See, it all comes down to sacrifice. The last thing we want here at the church is to have a whole lot of leaves, to look really healthy, to have everything going on, but be bearing no fruit. We don't want a semblance of life without the heart of prayer and devotion. We cannot miss our calling. We cannot miss that very thing that God is leading us towards. It's a heart of worship. It's saying, God, okay, it's not about the music. Music is not worship. It's not about the atmosphere. The atmosphere is not worship. It's not about how talented, well, Kathy is very talented. It's not about how talented the person up here is on the guitar or their vocals. It's about worship, and you can worship at any time by giving yourself to God. We don't want to just do things because they look nice, or that's what a church is supposed to do. We want to do things because this is what God has for us to do. In a minute, I'm going to pray. I'm going to invite Kathy up, and she's going to sing one of my favorite songs, Be Thou My Vision. And it's a fabulous song. After I pray, you are free to go. You can walk out the doors, you can grab food, you can go get your kids. We're dismissed. But I also want to say, don't lose this moment. As she's singing, if you'd like, the altars are open. If you say, okay, God, I have not really been worshiping you. I've been going through all the motions. I've been singing. I've been here. I've been doing the things that I thought I was supposed to do, but I have not actually been worshiping you. The things that I've been doing have been for me. This is a time where you can come to the altar and you say, okay, God, I've been doing it for me, but I want to do it for you. Show me my call. Help me worship you day in and day out. Help me remember that worship is not about how I feel. Church is not about me, but about the lost that are out there that need to know who Christ is. The church is not about something that I receive, but about something I give to a God who created everything, who gives me breaths to breathe, who created me, strange me, like me, and loves me. Maybe you're here today and you say, okay, I need to talk with God because I have not been right and God has not been my sight. I've been doing what I wanted to do. The altars are open. Feel free to come. Feel free to grab food. Feel free to grab our kids. But I want to say, this church is nothing without God. This church is nothing without a call on our individual lives. The pastor cannot do everything. The pastor's job is not to do everything. My job is to help you fulfill your call. And I want to do that from the bottom of my heart. So today I want to give you the opportunity to just come and say, okay, God, what is my call? What adventure do you have for me? What challenge, what path have you set me on? Where are you leading me? Maybe we could say it this way. God is saying, I've got this mighty, wonderful adventure. Whom shall I send? Who will go? And maybe our proper response should be, send me, Lord. Heavenly Father, Lord, I thank you for this day. And Father, I know that you are calling us to places and to people and to lives and to issues. And Father, I pray that you will open our hearts and open our minds and open our mouths so that our minds will think your thoughts, our hearts will feel your thoughts in your moves and your emotions, and our mouths will say your words. Father, I pray that you will be with us, that you will use our whole mind, body, strength. Lord, I pray that everything we have will be yours. And Father, I pray that you will be our vision here at Mount Carmel Church of the Nazarene, that you will be our vision, that we will see the lost, that we will love them and not accept no for an answer. Lord, I pray that we will be excited about fulfilling your call and sharing the gospel in our world. Father, you made trouble in the temple, and you make trouble in our lives. But Father, may we always fall into that trouble, fall into you. Father, here we are. Send us. You may go with the grace of God.
Be thou my vision, O Lord of my heart. Lord of my heart. Thou